It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, wild rice used to be a common sight in the Green Bay Area, providing a habitat for fish and food for migrating birds. We'll find out about a project this week that's bringing rice back to the water.
First, a number of doctors, dentists, and nurses in Wisconsin are under investigation. A report by the state's Controlled Substances Board revealed high rates of opioid prescriptions for their patients.
The board has been tracking prescription rates for opioids and other drugs since 2013. Its prescription drug monitoring program has been working in the midst of a growing epidemic of opioid-related deaths in Wisconsin and around the country.
David Wahlberg is a health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He's been covering this story. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
Can you talk to us about this group, the Controlled Substances Board? What is it and what do they do?
Yeah, it's a 9-member board, and three of them are Administrative folks, attorney general representative, and people from the departments of health services and agriculture. And then the other members are from some of the medical boards like dentistry and medical and pharmacy boards. And basically they oversee the prescribing of controlled substances in the state.
And they've been tracking these prescriptions, opioids in particular, for 5 years now. Where do these numbers come from? How do they get these numbers?
Yeah, so the prescription drug monitoring program started in 2013, and since that time, all pharmacies around the state and other places that dispense prescription drugs have had to report controlled substances to the board. So if you go to a pharmacy, they'll ask for your license, and you have to kind of fill out some information, and they track who is collecting those drugs around the state. And so they've basically produced reports, quarterly reports, tracking some of the trends from the dispensing.
And last week, the Controlled Substances Board referred, as we were saying, some medical professionals for investigation because of the amount of opioids that they'd prescribed. Can you talk about what kind of numbers we're talking about and what leads the board to make this recommendation?
Yeah, well, basically they say they can refer some of the data they collect to professional license boards if, quote, circumstances indicate suspicious or critically dangerous conduct. So they apparently thought that that might be the case with some of these top prescribers. They basically referred 7 doctors, 4 dentists, and 4 advanced practice nurses who had prescribed the most opioids among those professions, and then a dozen other dentists were kind of referred for a related reason.
And who does this investigation?
So basically the boards that represent those professions, so the dentistry board, the medical board, and the nursing board, referred these licensees to the state Department of Safety and Professional Services to be investigated. And the medical board folks, the doctors, are officially under investigation already. The nurses and the dentists are basically pending a screening process there by their boards to see if they will be officially under investigation by the state.
Talking to David Wahlberg, health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, about these referrals for investigation for some healthcare providers around the state believed to be prescribing a lot of opioid medications. David, we don't know the particular circumstances here. Hypothetically, it could be that one of these healthcare providers might specialize in dealing with people with chronic pain or severe pain situations. Hypothetically, there could be a reason, a valid reason, for all these prescriptions. Is that a possibility?
That is true. Yeah, the context is everything. So while one of the doctors apparently had roughly 1,200 prescriptions a month and about 100,000 doses of opioids per month, right, if that person runs a really busy pain clinic, that would mean something different than if it was somebody at sort of a small general medicine clinic.
There's a wider effort to try to bring down the number of opioid prescriptions in the state. What kind of trends have we seen over the last couple of years?
Yeah, so it's been a general reduction in opioid prescribing, at least since the beginning of 2015. Basically, if you look at this year from January through the end of September, we've had about 2.7 million opioid prescriptions. If you compare that to the same period 3 years ago in 2015, we're down about 28% since then.
What do we know about the opioid epidemic and what's happening in terms of addictions and fatalities related to these opioid drugs?
Yeah, so even though the amount of prescribing of opioids has been going down steadily, the deaths, at least so far in Wisconsin, have continued to go up. There were 883 opioid overdose deaths in the state last year, and that was a record. We don't know what the numbers are yet this year, and there are some indications around the country that at least the increase in deaths seems to be leveling off. So it'll be interesting to see if that is the case in Wisconsin this year.
Of course, the prescription opioid medications are just part of the story. Many of those opioid overdose deaths could be from illegally obtained medications or illegally produced and distributed drugs, illegal versions of fentanyl and others. So that's part of the reason that we might not see a correlation between prescriptions going down and fatalities.
Yes, and I think some addiction medicine doctors that I've talked to have said, you know, maybe part of the problem is that when they take patients off prescribed opioids, they aren't necessarily providing them with enough alternatives, and so that may be leading some people to turn to illicit drugs like heroin or the illegally produced fentanyl that you mentioned. So, there's sort of a move afoot to try to find other things for patients that can range from nerve blocks to other kinds of medication to over-the-counter pain medications to things like physical therapy and yoga.
That seems like a really critical point you've brought up there, David. And I've talked to addiction specialists. This is a very dangerous moment when someone goes off of their legal prescription if they're addicted to it. And as you say, that might be the moment they turn to illegal medications. Do you see, as you cover the story and you've been covering opioid-related issues for a while, do you see people really emphasizing that point you just made that people need additional treatment in that transition phase?
Yes, and I think that's related to maybe a stronger voice that's been raised by chronic pain patients. For example, there were some rallies in Wisconsin, including one in September in Madison, where people with chronic pain are basically saying, hey, you know, we need something to relieve our pain, and if you're not going to give us the level of opioids you used to, then we need something else. And I think doctors who are trying to abide by state and national recommendations back in 2016 to curb opioid prescriptions are now maybe trying harder to find alternatives for those kinds of patients.
And is part of the effort here to get the word out for doctors to maybe think twice before making that first opioid prescription, to look for different methods of pain treatment up front?
Yeah, that is one of the recommendations, to try something other than an opioid initially, or start people on a smaller dose initially. These are medications that can work well for pain, and many doctors remember working at a time about 20 years ago when they were really encouraged to view pain as a vital sign and treat for it. So I think they are doing that more, but it sort of takes some time to kind of make that cultural shift.
We'll leave it there for now. David, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, it's good to be with you.
That's David Wahlberg, health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He was with us to break down a new report on opioid prescriptions in the state from the Controlled Substances Board. That board has put some medical professionals under investigation because of their high rates of prescribing potentially addictive pain relief medications.
Coming up, we'll find out about a project that's bringing wild rice back to the Green Bay area. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how the chili pepper took over the world.
Right now, five locations in the waters around Green Bay are getting seeded with wild rice this week. Wild rice used to be plentiful in the area, and it provides a habitat for fish and food for migrating birds.
UW-Green Bay, Ducks Unlimited, and the Wisconsin DNR are all involved in the project that's part of a larger effort to improve the ecological health of the bay.
Amy Carazzino Lyon is the Green Bay Restoration Project Coordinator at UW-Green Bay. She joins us from our studios there. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Can you talk, please, about the scope of this project? How much rice over how much area are we talking about?
Yeah, so this week we're working at five different sites from the city of Green Bay here in the lower bay of Green Bay all the way up to Marinette, Wisconsin, so including the Green Bay West Shore. We're going to be seeding this week a total of about 2,000 pounds of wild rice on about 39 acres of coastal wetlands.
And let's back up just a little bit. Tell us about the plant that we call wild rice. What is it?
Sure. Wild rice is a native aquatic plant that grows in many of our wetlands here in the upper Midwest, and especially here in Wisconsin and Minnesota. It's a really beneficial plant for wetlands. It provides a lot of benefits for fish and wildlife, and also has a cultural and nutritional benefit for people as well.
And if I'm remembering from my days on the Larry Miller show talking about things like wild rice, is it actually a grass? It's not actually related to, say, white rice that we know from Asia.
Yeah, it is a wetland grass. There's a couple different varieties that occur all throughout the country, but the one that occurs up here in Wisconsin is northern wild rice.
And what is an ideal habitat for wild rice? Where does it really thrive?
So wild rice does best in shallow waters, particularly clear water with a little bit of a flow, light to moderate flow, so some movement in the water as well. It also really likes organic soft sediment, and in particular protected areas where it doesn't see too much wave action or storm activity.
And so this week you're in the process of seeding wild rice at five different locations. How did you select where this was going to happen?
Yeah, so we worked with a lot of local experts and also perused the literature to find out what characteristics we were looking for in coastal wetlands, and ended up selecting some of our wetlands on the Green Bay West Shore that worked well with the conditions we were looking for, that seemed like good opportunities to reestablish wild rice.
And I believe this is the third year of this project, is that right?
Yeah, so some of our sites, this will be the third year of seeding, and others it'll be the second. So it's the second to third year for all five sites.
And as we mentioned, this is a pretty large collaboration, UW-Green Bay, Ducks Unlimited, the DNR, other groups, I believe. How did all of you come together to work on this project? Why is it so important?
Yeah, it is quite the collaborative project. There's a number of folks involved, as you mentioned, and it was something that everyone felt strongly about. We're all very committed to restoring coastal wetlands in the Bay of Green Bay, and bringing our native wetland plants back is part of that. So we're all very excited about it, and it's been great to work with such a diverse group of folks to get the job done.
Now, wild rice has traditionally been an important crop for Native Americans. Is there a Native American component in this collaboration?
Yeah, it is a very important plant for many Native American tribes, and particularly those here in Wisconsin, from a cultural and spiritual standpoint, as well as the nutritional standpoint. It's been recognized the important value that the plant has for nourishment of both people and wildlife. So that's a very important consideration when working with wild rice.
So, Amy, walk us through the actual process of how you seed wild rice. I mean, I think a lot of us either have gardened ourselves or see other people gardening, but that's in soil. How do you seed something that's growing in an aquatic environment?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's actually very simple. Seeding pretty much just involves taking the seed that's been collected from this late summer from plants. Our seed stock comes from Minnesota, and we pretty much take it out into our sites that we're seeding and toss it out into the water and let it do its thing. It's really important for the seed to get into the sediment now in the late fall so that it has an opportunity to cold harden over winter, and that will help to stimulate germination next spring.
So it sounds like that process is a little bit like when we're planting native wildflowers or native prairie plants with needing some kind of pre-treatment before they'll actually develop.
Yes, exactly. It's very similar to that for gardeners.
We're talking with Amy Carazino-Lyon. She's the Green Bay Restoration Project Coordinator at UW Green Bay and is working on a project this week that is bringing together a large coalition of environmental groups, UW Green Bay, Ducks Unlimited, the DNR, and others who are reseeding wild rice in parts of the Bay of Green Bay. And does wild rice require reseeding every year, or is it a perennial crop?
Yeah, it's very interesting because wild rice is actually an annual plant for those who are familiar with annuals from gardening. It's very important for the native plants or the existing plants in the environment to go to seed to provide the seed stock for future years. And so with restoration projects, we typically try to seed wild rice at least 3 years in a row to allow for an opportunity for those plants to establish and also provide for some variability in the crop from year to year just based on environmental conditions.
So, Amy, you said that in some of the areas that you're planting this year, it's the third year, in some it's the second year. How successful have those sites been so far?
Yeah, we've seen quite the variety of success. We have several sites that even just after 1 year of seeding have been very productive. Interestingly enough, it just established right away, and we're continuing to monitor that to keep track of how well the plants are doing. We have some other sites that maybe face a few more challenges, and we're still working to really get a sustainable stock established there.
So as we've learned, whenever there's an effort for ecological restoration or reestablishing old environments that used to be present, it's not just one plant that or one animal or one insect that is key. It's a whole web of interconnection. Are there particular species that really help wild rice be sustainable in a particular area?
Yeah, well, as far as aquatic plants go, wild rice does very well existing with many of our other native aquatic plants here, including the emergent plants, so the plants that are able to be seen outside the water, as well as some of the submerged aquatic vegetation that would be underwater. But there's a lot of very close relationships with wildlife and fish that benefit from wild rice in coastal wetlands especially.
So we did mention that it makes for a good habitat for fish and also good food source for migrating birds. Are there particular mm-hmm. species of fish or birds that really rely on this crop?
Yeah, there's most of our waterfowl really benefit from wild rice, and in particular the group of waterfowl that we call the dabbling ducks, or those that sort of exist in some of the more inland or shallow water marshes, really like wild rice, and the time that rice is produced in the late summer, early fall is really critical for them to be able to find food at that time. And I think one of the lesser known benefits from wild rice and maybe from wetland restoration on a larger scale is the benefits to fish. Wild rice contributes structurally to diverse wetlands that support a lot of fish, including many of our important game fish here in Wisconsin, and also provides nursery habitat for young fish, which is particularly important from a management standpoint.
This might be outside the scope of your project, but are there efforts to track, say, how many of those fish species are increasing, or the presence of more migratory birds to kind of bolster the reasons to continue this type of project?
Yes, exactly. There's a lot of opportunity here in the Bay of Green Bay for monitoring, and we are actually currently working on a waterfowl monitoring project that is taking place at some of our wild rice restoration sites. So we have observers watching the fall migration to determine what species are using those areas and what kind of numbers we're seeing at the restoration sites.
Certainly, with any kind of restoration or work, ecological work in a public area, there's a need for outreach and education, and certainly the Green Bay area is a very highly touristed area. What ways have you been reaching out to people to explain what you're doing and getting buy-in for this kind of project in that area?
Right. It's really a unique place to work, and there's a lot of restoration work going on here beyond what we're doing, but I think one of the important connections we can make is also reaching out to the hunter and angler community in our area. A lot of folks are very involved in recreation on the bay, and all of the things that we're doing while providing fish and wildlife habitat also enhance recreational opportunities for people to enjoy hunting and fishing and also enjoy wildlife watching on the bay. So those are all things that are important to us in addition to the habitat restoration element.
And Amy, if you're able to get to a point where you feel like the wild rice restoration has been a success and you can move on to other ways to make the bay more ecologically healthy and diverse, what would be the next priority?
Yeah, well, we are looking at some other opportunities, including enhancing some diked wetland restoration sites to improve fish and wildlife habitat right in the city of Green Bay at a public park, and also looking to expand some opportunities for other habitat elements that will help fish and wildlife in the bay, such as woody debris and other structural components that are more difficult to find.
Well, Amy, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about the project.
Thank you for having me.
Amy Carazino-Lyon is the Green Bay Restoration Project Coordinator at UW Green Bay. She was with us to talk about the wild rice seeding that's happening in the area this week.
And on a side note, if any high school out there wants to take on the team mascot name Dabbling Ducks, I will be first in line to buy your t-shirt. Coming up after the news, are you a fan of chili peppers? Our guest traveled the world to find out what gives them their heat and flavor and how they've become such an important part of so many cultures and their cuisines. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, new research shows more than 75% of Wisconsin's counties are facing a shortage of psychiatrists. We'll talk to a researcher about why and what possible solutions are out there.
First, we know chili peppers can be hot and they add flavor and kick to everything from Memphis barbecue to Thai peanut sauce.
Beyond that, though, how much do we really know about them? Our next guest traveled the world in search of answers about where they came from, how they're eaten, and why they became super popular in so many different cultures.
Matt Gross is a New York City-based food and travel writer. His recent piece for Airbnb Magazine is titled How the Chili Pepper Took Over the World. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I understand this story is very personal for you because you are a chili fan, a chili head. What is it you like about chili peppers?
Oh, well, besides everything? I mean, I love the... It's a kick that is physical. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. Once you taste that chemical capsaicin in chili pepper, your tongue reacts, your mouth reacts, your brain reacts, your body reacts. There's nothing quite like that. And I love how that makes me extra attuned to the food I eat. Not just about that insane heat, it's about how the insane heat brings out all of the other flavors in a dish.
Well, and you had your first experience with a chili pepper at a pretty tender age, pun intended, at a farmer's market. Tell us about that story.
Sure. I mean, as I remember it, I was 10 years old, and my mother brought me to a farmer's market in Amherst, Massachusetts, where we lived, and must have been September, October, because some vendor had a bucket of chili peppers, cherry peppers, the sort of squat little things, and took a nibble of one, and I thought, this is not so bad, and took a huge bite and burned my face off. Unforgettable. And, you know, the great thing about chili peppers, when you OD on them at such a young age like that, you realize, I mean, this is, first of all, terrible, but also you survive it, and you survive it, and you kind of want more. You want that experience of living on the edge, of courting fate. And ever since then, I got more and more into hot sauces, chili sauces, plopping chilies in my food, and it's wound up bringing me around the world and exposing me to all kinds of foods and cultures that I never would have otherwise.
Now, here's the weirdest thing for me about this story of the spread of the chili pepper, Matt. There are cultures where we think, chili peppers, Thailand or India, parts of China, Hungary, parts of Africa. Oh, chili peppers, such a big part of their cuisine. They didn't have any of them just like 500 years ago, right?
Yeah, exactly. Chili peppers are native to the Americas. They emerged in the wild around Bolivia. They were first domesticated in what is now Mexico's Tehuacan Valley in the state of Puebla. And they didn't leave the Americas until a guy named Columbus showed up in 1492, and he and his people brought them back to Spain and Portugal. And from there, that's when the journey started. The short version of it is the Portuguese did it. They carried chilies to West Africa, to East Africa, to India, to Southeast Asia, and beyond. But all of those cuisines, Indian food didn't have chilies, Thai food didn't have chilies, Sichuan food in China didn't have chilies. It's crazy. And he didn't even have bell peppers either. Like, you think, oh, bell peppers seem like such a basic part of, you know, European cuisine, but that's just another form of chili pepper that they didn't have. So all of that stuff is completely new. The chili pepper, you know, in the span of a couple hundred years, just totally remade cooking all over the world.
And when they were first just in the Americas, do we have a sense of how many different varieties there were then and here?
There's something like 31 different species of chili peppers, but only five of them have really been domesticated. The most popular, they're all of the genus Capsicum. So they're all, the most popular ones are the Capsicum annuum, which includes the jalapeno, the Capsicum chinense, which includes the habanero and some of the, like, the most burn-your-face-off chilies in the universe, and the Capsicum frutescens, which is, I believe, like Tabasco peppers, Tabasco peppers are part of that category. Those are, like, the three worldwide most popular. There's a couple other domesticated ones, but they were all over, and within those species are, like, a zillion different, you know, slight variations, one that's more wrinkly, one with a thicker skin, one with a thinner skin, one that's, you know, some that are sweeter, some that are, you know, have a more dry flavor. And, of course, all different levels of heat within those different species.
Right. It's like dogs, right? I mean, Chihuahuas and Mastiffs are part of the same species, but they're pretty different. Same thing in the world of peppers, right?
Exactly. It's just like dogs, but it tastes better.
Let's not even go there.
So Matt, you talked about that there's a huge range of heat, and there's, I believe it's called the Scoville scale. How is it decided how hot a pepper is?
Oh man, so there's this guy, I think Ernest Scoville, Eugene Scoville, who over 100 years ago created this scale, and his idea was you would dry out chilies, you would soak them in a liquid, I think it was either an alcohol or water, to pull out the flavor, and then you would dilute that liquid in enormous parts of water until a panel of tasters could no longer sense the heat. So if it took 2,000 drops of water to counteract one drop of chili liquid, you would say that was 2,000 Scoville units, which is about what a jalapeno is. But that's crazy. That requires panels of testers, all this elaborate stuff, and it's hugely subjective. So in the last 20 or 30 years, they use something called high-performance laser chromatography, which basically just you take these dried chilies and extract some of their material, put it in a machine, and it says how much of the weight of this thing is made up of capsaicinoids, these chemicals that cause the feeling of heat. So that's a much more sort of scientific and locked down way. And they've matched it up so that what you get out of the machine corresponds to what these crazy panels of tasters were figuring out on their own 100 years ago. And, you know, the ranges go, you know, down from like 500 Scoville units, 2,000 Scoville units for things like jalapenos or Anaheim chilies, up to, you know, 150,000 for a habanero to, you know, 2 million Scoville units for the Carolina Reaper, which is currently, although maybe not for long, the holder of the Guinness World Record for the spiciest chili on earth.
Oh, we can't. You just teased that. What do you mean not for long?
So the guy who invented the Carolina Reaper, his name is Ed Curry, Smokin' Ed Curry. He's this crazy South Carolina farmer, has been developing something that he's called Pepper X, which is reportedly 3 million Scoville units, And, you know, that's like half again as spicy as the Carolina Reaper.
Now, we're talking like this is a similar thing as like pepper spray, right, in terms of the intensity?
Well, pepper spray is like 6 million to 15 million
single
units. So it's like half a dose of pepper spray. I mean,
your mouth.
Come on, that's nothing. But I got to taste Pepper X a couple of years ago at the NYC Hot Sauce Expo. Ed Curry was carrying around a little jar of mashed up Pepper X, and he gave me a tiny, you know, like an eighth of a teaspoon of it. And it's very hot. but it's also delicious. Like, I spent 10 minutes yelling into a friend's, you know, video phone about how delicious it was, how full of flavor, I mean, I was out of my mind at the time because of the heat, but it was really, it's really kind of amazing to see, to taste a pepper that is so insanely spicy, but also so incredibly flavorful. So, I mean, I'm super looking forward to when that thing gets its Guinness World Record and when he releases it to the public, because that's going to, it's going to change everything all over again.
We're talking about chili peppers with food and travel writer Matt Gross.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you like chilies? What's your favorite? Have you ever had a really, really hot one? Do you use them in your own cooking, or do you leave it to the pros? What questions do you have for Matt about chili peppers? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Matt Gross. He's a food and travel writer. He spent this summer in Jamaica, Hungary, and Thailand to learn about the origins of the chili pepper, how they're used, and why they're so popular around the world.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you love or fear chilies? What's the most memorable chili dish you've had? Where did you have it? Anything about chilies you've always wanted to know? Do you have a favorite to use in your own cooking? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
So, Matt, I want to ask a question about building up a tolerance for really hot peppers, because I worked in a Chinese restaurant for a long time. The cooks liked me, so they would share their own food with me, which was often quite spicy. I ate that a lot. And then I went and lived in Russia for a year, and Russians are not big on strong seasonings. Garlic is kind of the primary one. I came back thinking I could eat the same things I was eating here before I left and almost died because I had lost my tolerance. What is it? How do we build up a tolerance? And in places where they're really common, do people have a much higher level of what they can take?
I mean, the way to build up tolerance is just to eat. You have to, you know, start back at the bottom and work your way back to the top like Rocky. it's just how it goes. I mean, sure, you could launch back up to the hottest chilies, but you might not be able to take that. My wife, for example, after each of our kids was born, she totally lost her ability to take heat. So all of a sudden the kid was out, boom, she was back to square one. It was very frustrating. But, you know, she's worked her way back up each time, partly because we just have a lot of chilies around the house all the time. She's got no choice, really. In places I've been, like Thailand, I asked almost everybody that I interviewed to rate their chili tolerance. And the average Thai, I can tell you, rates their chili tolerance as above average. No one is ever willing to admit that they have only average Thai levels of chili tolerance. Everybody is slightly above average. And that can cause some crazy scenes. A friend of mine tells a story about a girl that he was dating in Thailand, and they would go out to eat, and she would measure her chili tolerance by his chili tolerance. He was new to the country. He was from New York. So she felt like she had to be able to eat things that were, you know, three times as spicy as he could eat. And this went on, but over time, his chili tolerance built up. So he started getting spicier food, and naturally she would get stuff that was still three times as spicy until, you know, they'd be at dinner and she would just be sweating and panting through the whole meal, unable to take the food that she'd ordered. But she was so determined because she was Thai that she had to be eating food that was way spicier than any foreigner could possibly eat. even if she couldn't eat it herself.
Spicy pepper arms races. Let's go to our callers now. Andrew is with us in Green Bay. Andrew, hi there.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good. Do you have a pepper story for us?
Yeah. So we're beginning farmers up in Green Bay, and my girlfriend is from New Mexico, so we decided that peppers were going to be one of our specialty. And we were searching through the catalogs, and we found this amazing heatless habanero pepper. So it's got all of the flavor of a habanero, as complex as it is, which I just love the flavor, but without any kind of heat. It's actually terrifying to eat because you're munching on it. You think that all of a sudden your face is going to burn off, but it just ends up in this sweet, amazing flavor that it's almost more addicting than the heat that comes with it.
I look forward to trying those, Andrew. Thanks for calling in, Matt. And that speaks to not just the heatless part, but there's a lot of flavor in these peppers and a lot of variety apart from the heat itself, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way people talk about it is kind of difficult. People will say things are fruity or citrusy or sweet, but sometimes you get things that are a lot more complex. There's a kind of dry heat. One of the things we think about when we talk about chilies is, where does that heat hit you, and how does it work with the flavor that's in the chili itself? Is it hitting you right in the front of the mouth, back of the throat, sides of the tongue? It's a series of pieces that all work together, ideally.
Let's go back to the phones, and William in Milwaukee is up. Hi, William.
Hello there.
What would you like to say?
All right, so I've got a bit of a story about my experiences with the Carolina Reaper.
You're alive, so we know how it ends, but fill us in the middle.
It was something special. So it was last year, in summer, with the Woodman's down Oak Creek, actually had Carolina Reapers in stock. So I decided, rather stupidly, to pick up a pack because I was planning on making chili that week.
Oh,
so
my
I was
gosh.
Like, so after cooking up all the other peppers in my cast iron skillet, mind you, so it's already starting to get a little tough to breathe inside, I decided to put on, just thinking, oh, this will help, just a bandana over my mouth and forehead, and just start cooking them up in a little butter. No, I started coughing. Everyone started coughing. The cats started coughing.
Oh, no.
And I basically had to vent out the entire house just to be sure that everyone stopped, you know, basically in the effects of tear gas. It was delicious when it all was said and done. But if you're going to cook Reapers, everyone, make sure to be in a well-ventilated area and please use like a gas mask or something.
William, thanks a lot. Is this a thing, Matt? We have to have occupational safety measures before we cook some of these things?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you should feel free to have the vents on, the windows open. I met some guys in Hungary who were not making traditional Hungarian paprika, but making crazy hot sauces with reapers and ghost peppers and stuff. And they had gas masks. If they're making hot sauce, they put on their gas masks because it just makes it easier. If you're around that all the time, you take precautions. And gloves, please, gloves when you're cutting some of those insanely hot peppers. I have made certain mistakes before with not wearing gloves, and I have paid dearly, and so have some people who are very close to me.
We're talking with Matt Gross right now. He's a food and travel writer and recently wrote a piece titled How the Chili Pepper Took Over the World. Let's go back to the phones, and Marty in Whitewater is up. Hi, Marty.
Hey, guys. My little story is, you know, my son and I, we like the hot stuff, and we've been in a couple of places where either we have to sign a piece of paper, a waiver, avoiding them of any liability, or we've had the chef stand in the doorway and watch us as we partake of the wings. But the best thing was we were in Galena. And it's nothing but shops on either side of the street, and we're walking. All of a sudden, here's this guy coming toward us, and he's stuck in wind. You know, he goes past us. We're looking at him like, what's wrong with this guy? So we proceed forward a little bit, and oh, here's a new hot sauce shop. So we walk in, and of course, here's a bowl of ghost pepper sauce. You put a little bit of this on the tip of a pencil and you're good to go, you know. But the best part is reading the labels of these bottles. You know, our favorite was it had four nuns on the label. There was like rocket flames coming out from underneath their garb, and it was called Holy Effin' Sauce. It was more fun reading the labels, and you know, it kind of tempered the heat.
Marty, thanks a lot. And Matt, a lot of creativity goes into naming the hot sauces, the hot pepper sauces on the market, and making them themselves. Can you talk a little bit about the world of variety when it comes to hot pepper sauces?
Oh my God, there's so many hot sauces out there. All of those, you know, very colorful labels with names of sauces that we probably can't necessarily even say on the radio.
True.
That comes out of this great tradition of people discovering hot sauce pretty much like in the 80s. Dave's Insanity Sauce was the first of those crazy, super hot, ultra graphic labels. And they've been joined, I mean, that sort of movement of, I don't know, like a lot of guys into like heavy metal and barbecue and, you know, this sort of like tough guy American culture created that world of hot sauce. And that's been joined in the last 5-10 years by a lot of immigrant hot sauces, a lot of people who have started making hot sauce like it was done in the old country, whether that's Guyana or Panama or Mozambique. And then there's a whole sort of segment of very restaurant-driven hot sauces, people experimenting with cool ingredients and new flavors. There's a woman who lives across the street from me in Brooklyn who goes by the name of Queen Majesty, who has like an amazing red habanero and coffee hot sauce. And it just sort of feels very in line with modern restaurant trends in terms of how flavors are put together. She's won a ton of awards for that hot sauce as well. And it just keeps expanding. Getting into making hot sauce is not that hard to do, not that expensive to do. And if you can make something that people love, people keep buying it and buying it and buying it.
Matt, I want to ask you about one of the three countries that you went to look at chilies, because it's Hungary. And I'm not sure that would be one of the first countries people would think of. But paprika is the national spice of Hungary. What is paprika?
Paprika is just ground dried chilies, but it has evolved over hundreds of years into the signature flavoring of Hungary. The chefs I talked to there said it was in probably about 2/3 of everything that everybody makes. It's in goulash and paprikash, and it's in little dishes on tables. It is, you know, the thing that defines Hungarian cuisine. You see peppers on T-shirts, you know, taking the place of the S in Budapest. Like, it's just, it's constantly everywhere. But in a lot of cases, the people I talked to there didn't even know where it had come from. It had been brought to Hungary in the 16th century by the Ottoman Empire, by the Turks who invaded and took over most of Hungary and brought peppers along with them, which they'd gotten from Arabs, which they'd gotten from the Portuguese. It's just a weird, like, long, long chain of handing off peppers from one person to the next, along with the wisdom about how to grow them, prepare them, cook with them, and eat them. Hungary is just suffused with this red everywhere you go, and people are very proud of it.
Matt, briefly, as we finish up, I understand you're working on a book about peppers. I hope you'll join us again for that. You went to Hungary, Thailand, and Jamaica for this article. Where's your next stop in your quest for peppers?
Oh, man. I want to go back to Thailand because there's a lot more to dig into there. I want to hop around Indonesia and try some more sambals, which are sort of like Indonesian-style salsas. I need to get to Mexico. Oh, man, I haven't been there in a long time, and that is, you know, that's the homeland.
All right, Matt, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me. I loved it.
That's Matt Gross, a food and travel writer. We've been talking about a recent piece he wrote called How the Chili Pepper Took Over the World. He's working on a book on that very topic. Again, we will hope to have him back. Still time for you to share your chili peppers, your favorites, your fears, your experiences for better or worse. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or as always, you can tweet us 24/7. At Central Time WPR. Halloween is over and done with, so Thanksgiving is next up on the holiday calendar, and snack food companies are getting on board the flavor train.
Pringles is offering a Thanksgiving experience in chip form. On the market now, turkey in a can, stuffing in a can, and to wrap things up, pumpkin pie in a can.
Pringles is not the first chip company to get on the Thanksgiving party. A couple years back, Lay's released a turkey-flavored chip. Judith, would you try these Thanksgiving-themed chips?
I would. I would be especially excited about the stuffing in a can because I love stuffing, and it's really all the spices and things like that. What I'm disappointed about is that there's no cranberry sauce in a can. I mean, there is, but not in a chip form.
Now, I say, has Willy Wonka taught us nothing? Here's what happens when Violet Beauregard tries the experimental gum that replicates a three-course meal.
Hey, the second course is coming up. Roast beef and a baked potato. Mmm.
With sour cream? What's for dessert, baby?
Dessert? Here it comes. Blueberry pie and cream. It's the most marvelous blueberry pie I've ever tasted.
Holy Toledo, what's happening to your face?
See, and then she swells up and turns into a giant blueberry. And I'm not saying that's going to happen if you eat these Thanksgiving-themed chips, but
no.
Yeah, what's to say it's not?
But I have to say,
legally, it will not.
There is something fun about Pringles anyway in the can. Mm. I just kind of like how they're stacked in there, so
yeah,
I don't know.
Thanksgiving. I don't know. I'm not seeking out Thanksgiving-themed snack products. That's just me, though.
Yeah, that is just you.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.